Over the weekend, authorities said they had foiled three potential mass shootings, arresting three men in three states, men who had publicly expressed their desires to carry out mass shootings. There were Facebook posts from one, text messages from another, and a video posted to Instagram from the third. These cases echo a Michigan case from 1995 that became the first criminal prosecution of threats on the internet. The essential question is, where does freedom of speech end and when does it become a crime? Retired FBI agent Greg Stascoll was based in Ann Arbor and led the investigation into this landmark case. Greg, welcome back. It's so good to see you.
It's good to see you, Cindy.
So before we get into this case from 95, a little context about where we are right now with clear patterns in mass shootings in this country. Men.
Correct.
Misogyny, hatred of women, expressing thoughts of or actually committing violent acts against women.
At least in a lot of situations, yes.
Yes. And many mass shootings have been predated by some kind of internet postings from the shooter, like we recently saw in El Paso. And
yes.
Any other patterns that jump out?
Well, I think there's usually a history not only of misogyny, hatred of women, but also other aspects of violence, maybe some social ineptness, inability to get along with people, and they tend to be sort of lost souls.
You played a very key part in a case going back to the dawn of internet and email in 1995 involving a University of Michigan student. Tell us about this case.
It involved an individual whose birth name was Abraham Jacob Alhobetz, and he used the name Jake Baker. And Jake was posting stories on what at that time they called an alternative website, in this case, Alt Sex. And his stories were characterized as snuff stories. He characterized them that way, and generally that's what they were. And what they did is they involved kidnapping, torture, rape, and ultimately murder of young women in these stories. And they were quite lurid and quite graphic. The stories by themselves were obviously fiction, but that coupled with some other things caught our attention.
What other things?
Well, first of all, the stories came to the attention of a Michigan alum who happened to be in Russia at the time. And he saw, based on Jake's IP address, that he had some affiliation with the University of Michigan. So he alerted the university, who in turn alerted the Department of Public Safety. And they began an investigation. They were troubled by this and by the stories, but then they got a search warrant and looked at his emails. In his emails, and there were emails to several different people, but one in particular, a guy that identified himself as Arthur Gonda, who apparently was living in Canada, and they had these exchanges wherein they talked about the stories, but they also talked about actually wanting to do it, and Jake talking about different scenarios as to how they could do it, how they could kidnap women. In his case, he was living in East Quad, lived across the hall from a bathroom. And he said, you know, we could grab a girl late at night, knock her out, get her out of the dorm. He even said, I've explored looking for some secluded spots where we could, you know, torture and rape or whatever these women.
And you got pulled in then because the Washtenaw County prosecutor told campus police, we got no laws to do anything with this?
And that was probably true at the time. Mm-hmm. The federal government, of course, our criminal statutes did not address the internet, not yet anyway. Yeah. And this is 1995 and they didn't. But I went back and looked and saw that we did have a statute that I thought applied, and that is communicating threats via interstate or foreign commerce, which the internet is clearly interstate and foreign commerce, and he was, in my estimation, communicating threats.
With someone in mind. So you presented these in federal court in Detroit before Judge Avern Cohn. How'd it go?
Well, first of all, I went to the U.S. attorney and got their authority to go forward, and we did, and I drafted a complaint and warrant, and we arrested Jake and took him in front of the U.S. magistrate for his initial arraignment. We did not ask for detention, but the magistrate was so troubled by the stuff that was in the affidavit and the stories and things that were attached that he decided on his own motion to detain Jake. Thereafter, the case was assigned to a U.S. District Court judge, that being Avern Cohn, and it was clear that Avern Cohn was not a big fan of this case. He's a big proponent of the First Amendment, which I understand. However, he ultimately ruled that, first of all, he told us when we do the indictment, we could not include the stories in the indictment because those were clearly protected by the First Amendment, which I'm not so sure I agree with. But at any rate, when we did the indictment, it only had the emails without the context of the stories, which actually mentioned an actual co-ed by name, her address, and in one case, her phone number. So without those stories, I felt the indictment was substantially weaker. But even with dropping the stories, Judge Cohn dismissed the indictment. And
Jake got out.
Jake got out.
What does this case show us about the difficulties that law enforcement today face in trying to figure out that borderline between free speech and a crime?
Well, and that is the problem. It's basically if threats are made and if they believe that they're within the protection of the First Amendment. And threats, the law is difficult. It kind of depends on how you're looking at it. And it has to be, I think, has to be looked at in context. But under common law, threats were what they call a general intent crime. That is, would a reasonable person believe that this is a threat? It's not the intent of the person making the threat. So by using that and going forward, we have to look and see, you know, how does this affect the community at large?
That old saying, your freedom of speech ends where my nose begins.
Yes, something like that. And clearly, in these most recent cases, at least law enforcement is opting to act proactively in the sense that they're saying, hey, we can't wait for these people to decide or if or when they're going to do it. Granted, there are a lot more threats out there than there are actual crimes. And law enforcement, you know, can't wait until the guy drives to El Paso and kills 20-some people. He posted just minutes before the attack. And as one of the things that I posit is, if that shooting had not taken place, would that have been considered a threat by the courts? So we'll see what happens with some of these most recent cases where law enforcement did act and they were found to possess weapons, high-capacity magazines, in some cases white nationalist or Nazi propaganda, those kind of things. And also in the case of the Dayton shooter where he had a history of misogyny, of clearly hatred of women.
So we shall see where these new three cases, how they're received by the judges, and if there's been anything that's changed since your case in 1995.
Yes, we will see.
Retired FBI agent Greg Staisgill, thank you so much.
You're welcome.